From NPR and WBUR in Boston, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. 3 months ago today, Russian tanks crossed into Ukraine, marking the start of a war that shows no sign of ending. Still, there may be cracks in Russian propaganda. Yesterday, a Russian diplomat publicly resigned, saying he has never been so ashamed of his country. Let's get some perspective now, 3 months on, from Sudarshan Raghavan. He's correspondent with the Washington Post. Our editorial partner has been covering the war since it began. Sudarshan, hello.
Hello, Scott. Great to be here.
Good to talk to you. Let's talk about this diplomat. Who is he and how significant is his public criticism of the war?
Well, Mr. Boris Bondarev, I mean, you know, he's a diplomat in Geneva, and to me, what he did is among the most courageous things I've seen, certainly by Russians, by Russian. Obviously, it's a sign that you know, there are many more, I think, Russians like him who are against the war, who are against what Vladimir Putin has done in Ukraine, and the suffering the Russian forces have caused on the Ukrainian people. I mean, the question now is, you know, will more diplomats, Russian diplomats, or even the Russian population follow suit, and also start to condemn the invasion? Of course, I'm sure this letter of his is not being disseminated at all in Russia. In fact, I'm sure, and the other piece, you know, Putin has cracked down so hard on dissent within Russia that it's, you know, it's unclear what kind of impact Mr. Bondarev's comments are going to be. But nevertheless, it is very courageous. I mean, this is a government that has poisoned its critics, and I'm sure Mr. Bondarev is probably concerned about his life at this stage at the moment.
Sure. Now let's look back at the moment when this conflict began. I remember speaking to your colleague Isabel Kershutian just before the invasion, and here is what she said 1 week before it all started.
People were just out and about. You don't see any shortages in supermarkets or a run on banks. We even went by, you know, the train station, the bus station to see if it was busy. I've had some, you know, other Washington Post colleagues flying in. They say the airport's like pretty dead. There's no, you know, rush to get out of here.
No rush to get out of here. And now here we are. Have you, Sudarshan, talked to regular people about that pre-war moment and how it looks now?
Absolutely. I mean, I was actually there a couple nights before the invasion. I was actually having dinner at a restaurant in Kyiv 4 hours before the invasion, and it was completely packed with people. No one had any idea. No one had any concerns about going home or packing their bags to flee.
Wow.
Of course, now, I mean, Yeah. And now it's a bit of a split screen effect now. I mean, you're seeing people in places like Kyiv and even in Dnipro, where I'm at now. Life has kind of returned back to normal because, you know, the Russians have been pushed back from the front lines of Kyiv. Kyiv is no longer, at least for now, a target. Dnipro has not, even though there has been some shelling here and there, but Dnipro has pretty much escaped the blistering bombardments that we've seen in other cities such as Mariupol and Kharkiv. So people here are extremely, you know, it's, you know, you can go to restaurants, you can, you know, you can even have a drink. I mean, it seems ridiculously normal. But just then, you go eastwards, and this is where the center of the war now, and the Russians are focusing on the eastern, the Donbas region, which is made of two provinces, Luhansk and Donetsk. And there, it's basically, it's almost a repeat of what we saw in Kyiv at the beginning of the war. People are fleeing their homes now. They're being evacuated. They're being attacked. The bombardments have been increasing, even reaching what were once towns that were considered safe. So yeah, it's a whole different situation. It's a bit of a split screen situation now in Ukraine.
And in the east, you recently reported from the front lines, and you were with some Ukrainian snipers. Did that give you a window into how the outnumbered Ukrainians are able to stand firm?
Absolutely. I mean, it's in those front lines, it's really a war of attrition. I mean, the enemy is rarely seen. In fact, both sides are basically involved in artillery battles back and forth, and they're using drones to surveil each other and target each other. They're using snipers. It's not the sort of hand-to-hand combat you saw in some places outside Kyiv when the Russians were trying to target Kyiv in places like Irpin or Bucha. But the but yeah, so it's a different kind of war happening in the East now. But certainly, what we're seeing is, you know, the what's clear is that even though the Russians have made it a focus for more than a month now, they're really struggling to gain ground. Ukrainians have been able to keep them back.
Okay. Okay. Siddharsan Raghavan, correspondent for the Washington Post. Thanks as always, and stay safe.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
Well, we're also watching primaries in a number of states today, Georgia, Minnesota, Alabama, Texas, Arkansas. Tea leaf readers are looking to parse the power of Donald Trump and the direction of the Republican Party as GOP voters in many races choose between candidates Trump's endorsed and those he's denigrated heading into the midterms. But Democrats will be facing more than Republicans in the fall. They'll be contending with history. And Julian Zelizer sees dark clouds on the horizon. He is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. We visit every week. Hi, Julian.
Hi, nice to be with you.
You too. And to that history, traditionally the party in power does suffer in the midterms, but you say things have, this is somehow worse in some ways. There's a strong economy, but inflation, the cost of things is going up. So stop there. Are you at the point of thinking Jimmy Carter in the 1970s?
Well, we don't know about re-election, but we can foresee where the midterms are going. I mean, midterms, as you said, historically go poorly. So you're fighting against that if you're a Democratic president and party. And then we just have a series of events from inflation pinching American voters to the stock market turbulence and to turbulence overseas. And so it's not the kind of mix that you want. If you're the party in power going into the election.
But then there's Ukraine. You know, we know NATO is more united than ever. There's bipartisan support in Washington, Ukraine. But you're right. You know, it would seem as if that would be sort of a power to propel the Democrats. It seems pretty noble. But you're right, Biden isn't getting credit for this.
I think that's... Yeah, I think it's true. I mean, I think, foreign policy isn't usually the foremost issue in a campaign. And so it's more, are things stable for the voter or not? And this could create a sense of instability. And a lot of what Biden is doing is trying to avoid military conflict and contain Russia. So it's subtle what he's doing. He's uniting an alliance. He's putting economic pressure on Russia. But it's not clear that's translating, at least from the polls, into public support for his policies.
Yeah, Fox News is running a banner. Polls show Americans care more about the economy than punishing Russia. And here's where we have to ask. You write that the first midterm is a referendum on the president. So is this, you know, I mean, it's a war that is going to go on for a long time, and Americans might be seeing dollars going to Ukraine and watching, you know, the cost of their own gas going up, and, you know, there may be some irritation there. But is this also about Biden? You know, Obama was one of the most charismatic presidents we've had in a long time. He got, as he said, shellacked in the midterms. But is Biden, you know, inspirational?
Well, look, if a president is struggling in the polls, it's fair to ask what are some of the mistakes that the president might be making politically. And I think some of the lost in translation element of the administration, kind of why is the strong unemployment numbers, why are those numbers not front and center over inflation, or why are the successes in creating an alliance overseas not at the forefront? Part of this is how the president is able to convey these accomplishments or not convey them to the public.
Yeah. Well, then you've got the upcoming Supreme Court ruling, possibly overturning Roe v. Wade and a woman's right to choose. The NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll out last week finds 2/3 of Democrats say they're more likely to vote in November. But Republicans are also very energized by that possible ruling. You know, is there an historic precedent for what this might do?
Well, it could help Democrats in that Republicans are going to be mobilized because the midterms usually do focus on the president. And so the opposition is out to vote and to try to contain the president's power. But the question is, does this pending decision mobilize suburban female voters, for example, who were so important in 2018 and 2020? So there might be some political benefit, so to speak, for the Democrats in that respect. But I think you're right. Both parties are going to be very energized, and so it might politically cancel each other out.
Well, and Biden has been characterizing Republicans as extremists lately. He used these terms like ultra-MAGA agenda. You know, is that a direction you think he should be going in?
It's a strong argument. Bill Clinton, President Clinton, did it in 98 while he was being impeached, and he presented Newt Gingrich and the Republicans as far off the political center, and that helped the Democrats. But it's not clear, given the number of issues, including economic issues, that the nation faces, whether that strategy will work in the midterms. It might very well work in 2024. I think it's a strong argument, but it's not clear in the next few months how that goes.
Well, and the issues keep coming. Formula. Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. His latest book is The Presidency of Donald J. Trump, A First Historical Assessment. Julian, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
So are you shopping for a new house? Sorry to hear. In this red-hot housing market, things are so expensive, but there may be signs of cooling. Last month, sales of new single-family homes fell about 17%, according to the Commerce Department. That's good news to Derek Thompson, staff writer for The Atlantic, because he argued the housing market has peaked. And Derek joins us on Skype. Happy Tuesday.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So, Derek, in my neighborhood in the DC burbs, there was an open house last month. More than 40 people came in just a couple hours, just housing crazy. Are you arguing that the bidding wars, offering way over asking price, no inspection, is going to ease?
Yes, I do think it's going to ease. And it's going to ease for a very simple reason, which is that mortgage rates are going way, way up. The increase in mortgage rates right now is the highest we've seen in 40 or 50 years. That doesn't mean that mortgage interest rates are higher than they've been in 40, 50 years. Mortgage interest rates are actually still pretty low. They're lower than any
pretty
time
low.
In the 1990s or early 2000s. But the rate is increasing, and it will keep increasing because the Federal Reserve will keep jacking up its own interest rates, and mortgage rates will follow. So we are at a really, really high point in the housing market, and it is likely to stabilize, if not outright decline.
But hold on, during the pandemic, the economists were telling us and telling you that a lot of people saved up a load of money during this pandemic. So can a lot of people still afford to buy?
Yeah, a lot of people can definitely still afford to buy. A lot of people can afford to buy, you know, anything. Houses are really expensive. So, you know, if you saved an extra $10,000, $20,000 during the pandemic, that's sensational. You're in a better place than you were 2-3 years ago. But that $10,000, $20,000 might not be the difference between being able to afford or not afford a house that's, you know, $400,000, $500,000 over $1 million, let's say. So it's more likely, I think, as the housing market keeps getting hotter and mortgage interest rates keep getting higher, that people say, all right, what can we do with this $10,000 to $20,000? Maybe we can buy an extra couch. Maybe we can go on an extra, you know, long weekend vacation. I think what you're starting to see in the numbers, as you said at the top of the segment, you're going to see housing sales decline a little bit. You're going to see housing prices start to stabilize. And we're going to sort of be at this high plateau of housing prices for quite a while.
Mm. Okay. Derek, if you have a $10,000 couch, that's a whole nother segment we're going to have to discuss.
Yeah, right.
But let's talk about housing starts. They're up, a sign of more supply to come. But don't we still have supply chain issues? I mean, I don't want to keep going on about my neighborhood, but one build that just finished took twice the normal time.
Absolutely. One really interesting thing that we're beginning to see is that the difference between housing starts and housing completions is rising. And is right now, in fact, at a record high. That means there's a lot of unfinished homes. Why are there so many unfinished homes? Well, it's because, briefly, the supply chain is totally messed up. It's messed up for my $10,000, $20,000 couch. It's messed up for your $50,000 couch. It's messed up for the houses. It's messed up for the cars. It's messed up for computer chips. It's messed up for all sorts of things. And, you know, we've done lots of segments about why supply chains are so screwy. A lot of it has to do with China's policy. A lot of it has to do with the fact that we don't have domestic supply. But in any case, that supply crunch has led to a situation where houses are harder to finish. The doors are harder to finish, the stairs. And so you have a lot of unfinished homes on the market, which is an interesting phenomenon we haven't really seen at this rate in many, many decades.
Yeah. Home prices in the past 2 years are up 35%, really steep climb, faster than what we saw just before. Wait for it, right? Housing crash 2008. Any chance that this could be a bubble that isn't just going to ease, but could burst?
There is a chance of anything. I wish I could see the future in 2 years, but I cannot. So there's a chance of anything. The question is it likely? The writer economist who predicted the housing bubble crash of 2007-2008 that I consult quite often, his name is Bill McBride. He pointed out that in 2005-2006, the reason that we saw this crash is because inventory soared to a multi-decade high. Inventory, that is the number of available homes in many local markets, are really close to all-time lows. So in a lot of ways, the situation with the American housing market is kind of the opposite of what we had 2005-2006. Really, really low inventory rather than really, really high. This is a market where, for better or worse, we're likely to see prices stabilize, maybe fall a little bit in inflation-adjusted terms like they did in the late 1970s, early 1980s. That is more likely, I think, than an outright crash like we saw in 2007.
Okay. Okay, finally, very quickly, does this present good news for first-time home buyers, or is still out of reach for many of them?
The situation right now for first-time home buyers is really bad. I was going to use a worse word, but it's really bad. Homes are really expensive right now, and that stinks. The good news is that with mortgage interest rates rising, you know, it might get a little bit easier to compete for a home that you can afford. Whereas today, if there's a home you can afford, there's 40 bidders, and that means you're likely to lose.
Yeah. Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic. Thank you as always.
Thank you.
Well, more Americans are now spending at least part of their work week at home. That can be a good thing unless you have bad furniture. For instance, a chair that just crushes your back. Some people use yoga balls or kneeling chairs. They require the use of your core muscles to balance your core, support your back. And in Europe, active sitting chairs have become popular. They have a seat on a spring or a rolling device, and that forces you to maintain your balance. Well, the intrepid John Kalish introduces us to a Vermont doctor who's designed his own chair.
When you spend several hours a day on a traditional office chair, you're hardly using your muscles at all. But active sitting chairs force you to use the muscles in your back and abdomen, the so-called core muscles, to remain seated. The body is burning fatty acids known as lipids as fuel for those muscles. It's a healthier way of sitting, says Herman Ponzer, an evolutionary anthropologist at Duke University who studies metabolism.
If you are completely just limp, laying in a chair like a wet wash rag, then you aren't pulling those lipids in. There's no need for them. So they just continue to pass the muscles by and continue to just float around in your bloodstream. So keeping your muscles active in these otherwise resting postures keeps us healthy.
Healthy in the sense that back pain is less likely, and burning calories to remain balanced in your seat lessens the chances of such metabolic diseases as obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. Turner Osler spent 30 years as a trauma surgeon in Vermont. When he retired from the operating room and started working as a researcher, he developed back pain.
I just sort of suffered with it for a few years before I said, this is the sort of problem that needs to be figured out. And I've got the tools. I've studied math and statistics and surgery and anatomy and epidemiology. So if anybody has a chance to riddle this out, I do.
Dr. Osler believed that his back pain was the result of sitting so much. He bought a bunch of expensive active sitting chairs, which are popular in Europe, and became convinced he could create something better and cheaper. So he and his son started a company called Core 360 to make active sitting chairs in Vermont. Core 360's chair looks like a traditional office chair without a back or armrests. It has a patented rocking mechanism consisting of two intersecting cylinders that enables the seat to tilt in all directions. The company has sold its chairs in 31 countries and expects to sell its 10,000th chair by the end of the year. Core 360 also gives away plans for a kid's chair to do-it-yourselfers. So far, the plans have been downloaded more than 2,000 times. At one Vermont school, 100 of the kids' chairs were made, thanks to the husband of a school employee who owns a woodworking business. At Westford Elementary School, the second graders get to decide whether they'll sit on a traditional chair or the DIY version of Core 360's chair, called the button chair. Its round felt seat is secured to the wooden base with bungee cord, causing it to look like a button with four holes for thread. The seat rests on a small ball, so kids have to balance themselves on it. Here's 8-year-old Solvay Wammer.
Sitting in those normal chairs felt like normal, and I wanted to try something new. I am able to put my feet down, and they just keep me from falling off the chair.
Her classmate, Sebastian Pante, has fallen off his chair a couple of times, but he's still keen on it.
It's just really comfy, and you can move around in it. I really like moving around, and it helps me get out more energy.
Sebastian Pante is far from the only child in the elementary school with energy to burn, says counselor Stephanie Jones.
A lot of kids use hand fidgets to help them stay focused, and this is an actual chair fidget almost that helps students that need to move a little bit stay at their seat and continue to work.
The kids' chairs can be made with $10 worth of plywood, says Turner Osler.
We put hundreds of active chairs under kids for basically no money. It's as though you're stuffing a chair through the internet. You know, it just emerges at the other end if somebody has a CNC router and some plywood.
If you don't have access to a computerized cutting machine, there are also free plans for cutting the plywood with hand tools. Turner Osler says that by promoting active sitting, he's hoping to have an impact on public health. When he was a surgeon, Osler could help one patient at a time, but now, he says, that reach is extended to everyone. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish.
And to see pictures of this button chair, there it is. It's amazing, with the tennis ball in there. And for a link to the free blueprint, go to hereandnow.org. I'm afraid I would fall.
Native tribes in northwest Montana are now managing 18,000 acres of land, once known as the National Bison Range. The Biden administration returned the land to the tribes in 2020, more than a century after the government took it from them. As tribes manage this territory, Montana Public Radio's Freddie Menares reports that tribal members are updating and correcting the history that tourists learn when they visit the range.
A narrow gravel road takes visitors up a mountain alongside a creek, and if they're lucky, they'll see buffalo roaming freely on the terrain. The Bison Range sits on more than 18,000 acres of undeveloped land in northwest Montana, land taken by the U.S. government without the tribe's consent. In 2020, Congress passed a law that transitions management of the land from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service back to the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, who signed off on the law, says with the loss of tribal homelands and depletion of bison herds, Plains tribes lost traditional connections with the mammal.
But in spite of that tragedy and loss, we are still here. You are still here. And that's something to celebrate.
Haaland says returning management of the land to the tribes is a culmination of Native people's resilience, conservation guided by indigenous knowledge, and the Biden administration's commitment to honor treaty obligations.
When our indigenous ancestors lived on this land alongside the plethora of animals, and they each respected their place in the balance of nature.
She says the people then relied on bison for food and subsistence, believing future generations would do the same.
We all know that history took a tragic and brutal turn after that.
Indigenous people were colonized and settlers hunted bison near extinction. And that history wasn't represented accurately at the Bison Range's Visitor Center. Whisper Camel Means is the tribe's division manager for the Wildlife Refuge.
And when you came here previously and looked at some of the ways that things were put out, the story wasn't quite correct.
The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes have made corrections to exhibits inside the visitor center located on the Flathead Reservation. The tribes tried to change the information in the past but couldn't because they say the Fish and Wildlife Service prioritized wildlife preservation. Camel Mean says the exhibits there previously used a different tribe's word for bison.
We're not a lumped together Indian language, Indian things. We're Salish, we're Kalispe, we're Kasenka. We all have different stories.
The Visitor Center is now open, featuring new exhibits that better reflect the tribe's involvement in bison conservation. Oral histories now included there recount how the U.S. discriminated against and excluded tribal members from land management operations when it was turned into a wildlife refuge. A documentary titled In the Spirit of Atatice sets the record straight about who initially brought bison to the area. Stephanie Gillen, the education program manager for the tribe's natural resources program, says she worked with cultural committees to get the correct history for the new exhibits.
We listen to our elders to where some stuff we have to protect, because if we don't, if we put it out there, we lose, you know, what it gives to us. You know, we lose that power it gives to us.
Generational trauma, Gillen says, is still felt today within tribal communities, and correcting the information at the visitor center is about respect and preserving their history. The tribes are working to build a bigger museum that will be closer to the interstate. It's a push to share their history with more people. For NPR News, I'm Freddie Monatis in Moise.
Every morning, I feed the cats and glance at some daily readings, including my daily Stoic, selected sayings from the ancient Roman philosophers. Have you heard about this? The Stoics, Marcus Aurelius, Seneca, and Epictetus, are having quite an afterlife. I like their core thinking, which, very simply put, is live virtuously and have the wisdom to know the things you can't control. That part reminds me a little of the 12 steps. Well, it turns out CEOs like Jeff Bezos and Warren Buffett, rapper T-Pain, former Defense Secretary James Mattis have all become followers. And for millions of others, there are podcasts, TED Talks, YouTube channels, daily emails. It's quite a movement. Now, we know a smaller offshoot of followers, mostly right-wing men, are using Stoicism to not take responsibility for everything from inequity to misogyny and racism. Vice reports on a man in Europe who was fired for using a racial slur. He sued, saying he was just practicing his religion, Stoicism, which means he can't control other people's reactions to his words. Oh, no. Our next guest says that is not Stoicism. So what is? Let's bring in Yale Classics and Philosophy Professor Brad Inwood. Professor, welcome.
Nice to be here.
People take years-long courses on this. You've studied it, I understand, in Latin.
But Latin and Greek.
Oh, boy. Well, briefly, we know the first Stoics were Greeks, but a lot of their writings are gone. So much remains of the Roman Stoics. Tell us, who were they and what were their core beliefs?
Ah, well, Stoicism, I guess they, if there was a short phrase which captures what they believed in, it was the importance of nature. You describe their motto as following virtue is the way to live. The way they put it was actually follow nature. We have an intimate connection with the natural environment, and we're supposed to enhance it and support it, just as we have an intimate connection with other human beings and other rational creatures. And being active in promoting those values is part of the natural life.
Don't worry about things beyond your control.
So that idea of distinguishing between things that are under your control and things that are not under your control and making that the foundation of clear thinking about your life, that's actually not Stoicism in general. That's particularly Epictetus. His idea was that it was really important to understand we can't do all kinds of things, but there's lots of things we can do because our minds we can control. So in focusing on doing things that are going to be rational successes, what it's focusing on is you can't guarantee success. Distinguishing what you can control and what you can't control is about how you react to a failure. Mm-hmm. It's not about whether or not you should try. It's about how you should respond when things don't go exactly as you would wish. And of course, that's going to happen as soon as you engage with the world.
Some of the criticism of the modern day interpretation, this idea, well, I just can't do anything, is that the Stoics would have evolved. I mean, back then, they had a terrible plague. Nothing they mm-hmm. could do about it. But today, they might have been the first to rationally say, hey, let's get some vaccines.
They absolutely would. And the point about distinguishing between what you can control and what you can't doesn't really address the question of how much effort you should make. Say you want to develop a vaccine. you can't guarantee success. Maybe your lab won't find the vaccine. Then you're not going to decide it was a mistake to try. Trying is in your control. Succeeding is up in the air.
Some today are interpreting that as, you know, world poverty, climate change, beyond my control. And, you know, scholars are saying they lived in a different time. You have to put it in the context of what some of the things were they felt they could not control. I mean, there was obviously war.
Right. Stoicism can't be an excuse for not taking action. In fact, in the ancient world, of all the ancient philosophical schools around, the Stoics were the most engaged with trying to make a positive difference in the world.
It seems like that's what I think Seneca especially is saying. It's not the destination, it's the journey.
Well, I think that's a good way to summarize it. He didn't really invent that idea. That goes back to the earliest days of the school.
And I'm just going to list some of the things that others have said as they try to encapsulate this. Have kinship towards other humans. Don't whine or gossip. Rehearse all the bad things that could happen to us, including death.
Well, the Stoics, like many other ancient schools of philosophy, did think it was important for people to have an appropriately detached attitude towards death. Death was something that could come to anybody at any time. Was a lot of plagues and disease around. So having a good attitude towards death was an important feature in living your life.
And what about emotion? You know, we think we know the word Stoic, even if you don't know this new modern Stoic movement. You know, we think of Stoic as someone who, without emotion, faces life challenges. And that's another criticism in some quarters, that some modern Stoics are instead using it to discourage emotion. My wonderful surgeon is a Stoic practicing the new movement, and he knows that I'm dabbling in it. And when he told me I might have to have another surgery after the stupid fall I took, you know, he said, now be a Stoic. Don't see this as something happening to you. See this as something, you know, a miracle that's there for you. I thought that was wonderful, and I'm going to do that. But also, I got a little glimpse at there's no room to be sad, you know, about maybe having to have another surgery. And that's the criticism of some of this modern Stoicism, that it's this man-up thing. What did the Stoics really believe?
One of the tricky things here is this word that we translate as emotion. It's coming from a Greek word that is actually somewhat better translated as passion. Now, what is a passion as opposed to an emotion? If I have a feeling of affection for my wife or my children, that's an emotion. Stoics had no problem with that. A passion is a violent emotion that you have no control over. So if I am angry with somebody and lose perspective and say things that I regret, that's a passion. So getting rid of all your passions means not getting rid of emotions, but controlling them. Nothing wrong with love, nothing wrong with caution. Fear that you can't control that makes you kind of melt and get disorganized, that's a passion, and that's what they're against.
What about grief? Because Petrarch wrote what seemed like a response, and he seemed to be saying, for instance, when it came to the plague, no, there's no rational meaning for a plague upon our people. And sometimes you just have to weep.
Yes. So grief is a really tough case because part of their notion of accepting what nature gives you involves coming to terms with the death of a loved one. Grief is the rational response, we would think. But an ancient Stoic would have thought the death of a spouse, a child, a parent, is just part of the natural flow of things. And letting your response to that get out of control, they did think was irrational. Well, here's the other thing about ancient Stoicism that really changes our assessment of what they were up to. They also thought that the world was providentially structured by a rational, benevolent force, nature, God. And if you think not just that the world is rational, but that it's structured by a benevolent force, then there's an extra reason not to beat your head against the wall when something bad happens. So when Petrarch says there's no meaning, if there's a plague that kills, you know, a million people in the last 2 years, that's going to be seen differently by an ancient Stoic. They wouldn't accept that there was no meaning to it.
What do you think the modern Stoics are getting right?
Oh, that's very interesting. Some of the modern Stoics that are really doing important good work are those who emphasize the importance of bringing articulate, self-conscious, rational thought to bear on the problems you face in your life, using your rationality in connection with an appreciation of nature to improve your life. A lot of modern Stoics are focusing on that. And as you've reminded me, a lot of people aren't. I wouldn't want to lump both groups together. I think there's two very different things going on.
Yeah.
One of the first things I read when I was starting to engage with Stoicism when I was a very young man was an article in the Atlantic Monthly by Admiral James Stockdale, who was, as you may know, was a fighter pilot in the Vietnam War and was shot down and was a prisoner of war. He attributed his psychological survival in those horrendous conditions to the fact that he had studied Epictetus when he was a student at Stanford. And I think that connection between the kind of intellectual self-control and survival in tough times, the connection of that to Stoicism and to the military, does go back a long way. One of the lessons they teach is the importance of personal integrity. The desire to make a positive impact in the world and the desire at the same time to preserve your integrity presents people with dilemmas all the time.
You remind us that Seneca was a tutor to the spoiled brat Emperor Nero. So he had his struggles there. That's Yale Professor of Classics and Philosophy, Brad Inwood. Professor, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
It is graduation season, and here's a surprising number. Only 62% of students graduate college in 6 years in this country, and the number drops to 39% for black male students. In Tennessee, where the rate is even lower for black males, the state's education department has launched a task force to address this disparity. Damon Mitchell of member station WPLN reports.
All baccalaureate degrees candidates, please rise.
Students in the class of 2011 at the University of Memphis in Tennessee sat in a large auditorium as many of their loved ones celebrated their next chapter of life.
Terrence Deshaun Thomas. Tanisha M. Tutwiler.
As they walked across the stage in their caps and gowns, there was one name that wasn't called. Jamel Turner, who was black and from Memphis, dropped out the prior year because of financial troubles. He had a 3.8 GPA and big aspirations for law school.
You know, it was very important to me to be a graduate. You know, I wanted to be a representative. I was going to be, at that time, the first in my family to graduate.
But he needed to apply for federal financial aid and complete the application known as FAFSA.
So I was actually a junior, and I was doing my own FAFSA and, you know, handling my own. And my mom was like, I need the tax credit, will help me out a lot if you would let me put you on my taxes and I would have to do your FAFSA.
Turner agreed to let his mom claim him on her taxes, giving her a better return. But she didn't follow through with completing his financial aid application, the money he needed for tuition and housing.
Well, because I was staying on campus, I owed like $2,300 and I couldn't, the school wouldn't move forward with me on anything until I paid the money back. And I was just a college kid, you know, I was making $1,000 a month.
Getting kicked out of college because he couldn't pay led to a downward spiral. Turner lost his housing and started sleeping in his car. He essentially gave up on his future. And even though it happened in 2010, he still hasn't processed the devastation caused by his mom not holding up her end of the deal.
So I told my mom the other day, because I'm ready to get over it, so I'm about to start therapy. I was just telling her, you know, I lived in the city. I went to school in the city. I moved myself in and out of my dorm by myself every time.
Turner's story is symbolic of a pattern for black males across the U.S. According to the National Student Clearinghouse, black males are the least likely to graduate from college compared with other students. And in Tennessee, the 6-year graduation rate for black males at public universities is at least 20 percentage points below the rates of their peers in a given year. That's why the Tennessee Higher Education Commission developed the Black Male Success Initiative to address the issue. Sean Boyd is a member of the state's task force.
Even to get this many people in one space to say, hey, we have a problem, because if I think back 5 years ago, we didn't have this. You know, nobody really was talking about it.
Boyd says the group is starting listening tours at campuses around Tennessee to hear from black males about their experiences in college.
We have to really reimagine college and not just say, hey, go to college, like what was done to me.
A recent report from the group pointed to several barriers preventing black males from getting a degree. Not feeling like they belong on college campuses, being stereotyped as at risk, and having unmet financial needs. But some of those barriers also affect other groups of students, like Latinos, black women, and some white people. all of whom are graduating from public colleges at higher rates than black males. Daryl Miller works as a coach at Persist Nashville. It's a nonprofit that aims to help students succeed in college. Miller says black males are faced with mental health disparities that their peers don't have.
I think that us as African Americans have too much pride as well. What do we look like to go sit down and speak with somebody who doesn't know us from Adam and Eve and express how we feel or have been feeling in the past? Are they really going to listen to us?
Miller says many of the high school and college students he works with also aren't exposed to high-paying career options. Not being pushed toward those fields can make side hustles feel like a better option.
And like I have students I speak to all the time, and a lot of them just straight up tell me I don't have to go to school to get money at this point in 2022.
And a lot of black males, he says, see college as a bad investment if the result is a low-paying job or no job at all. And there's truth to that. According to the nonprofit group Young Invincibles, racial employment gaps are still a thing despite a good job market. Data show that young black males with a bachelor's degree have the same chance of getting a job as their white counterparts with an associate's.
We don't want to be stuck with debt at 18 to 21 years old and end up not using that degree because we can't get hired because of lack of experience.
For black males who do want to get a degree, Jamel Turner has this suggestion.
I think that we should put therapy in these schools. I think that we should get these boys talking.
He believes undealt with traumas put a lot of young black males off track. Having access to therapy while in college could be the key to successfully completing a degree. That's in addition to Tennessee's Black Male Success Initiative's plans to make recommendations for providing black males with more financial support and mentorship programs. For Here and Now, I'm Damon Mitchell.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now.